The Tampa Bay Rays have signed Ha-Seong Kim, while both the Royals and Reds are making additions. Let's talk about it. Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Thursday, January 30th, your source of news, notes, and updates on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. Follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. He's Troy Brock, Troy B Baseball on the Twitter machine. Tell all your friends. I almost said both your friends. Tell all your friends to go to firstpitchpodcast.com to get every single episode of First Pitch every single morning. And Troy, I want to talk about Tommy Canley to the Tigers. Maybe the Reds and Royals both added some pitching, one via trade, one via signing. But Ha-Seong Kim went to the Tampa Bay Rays. 2 years, $29 million. He does have an opt-out after the first season, which, reminder here, he had shoulder surgery late in the year last year. He will not be available to start this season as he rehabs. The $13 million deal this year, $16 million in 2026 if he doesn't opt out, with $2 million worth of incentives this year. This kind of honestly feels like the ideal fit to me, because they haven't really satisfactorily answered shortstop, right? They do have guys who can play shortstop, but they haven't really answered the question. And they have a no doubt shortstop in the minors in Carson Williams, who just isn't quite ready yet to go to the major league level. Was this the best place that Ha-Seong Kim could have gone, or would a better fit have been somewhere like the Yankees or the Braves, who could have eventually folded him in once he was healthy?
No, this is probably the best place for Ha-Seong Kim, because he's in a good position. The Tampa Bay Rays help develop their players well. Even their veterans that they get, most of them wind up better after they spend time with the Rays and turn into better players than anybody ever dreamed of. And while he hasn't been absolutely atrocious offensively throughout his career, he has a 99 OPS plus, so he's been pretty much right there at league average, and he's a really good defender. And after spending some time with the Tampa Bay Rays, he might become a better hitter and be more evenly skilled between his offense and his defense.
Yeah, Taylor Walls was the most commonly used shortstop last year. -0.2 WAR, 26% strikeout rate, 529 OPS plus. Definitely the weak link on the offense. And I don't think defensively he was that impressive either. And so it's something where you could absolutely see a scenario where Walls can play short until Kim is ready. And when Kim comes in, you can either move Walls to a utility thing, or if you have some sort of injury, you know, maybe Brandon Lau gets hurt, you can move Walls over to second. They've also got other guys who can play at Jose Caballero, things like that. It does feel like this is like, plus you get to play in a minor league park, right? You get to play in the Yankee spring training facility. So your offense should theoretically look a little bit better versus playing somewhere else. And then the Rays do have other guys who can fill in around it. You know, like you've got Christopher Morel, who is bad defensively everywhere, but can play a bunch of places. Jonathan Aranda can play second base. Like, they've got options, so they can move guys around. They don't need him right now, but he gets plenty of money, and you have the option to do something. Is the deal too much, or is this a good salary for a guy who, like you said, defensively has been very good, offensively has been average so far, but has shown the potential to maybe do more as far as stolen bases, as far as doing, you know, maybe hitting for a little bit more power in this park? Is this a good salary for him, for both teams, really, both sides?
I definitely think it's more a good salary for him than for the Rays. I actually texted one of my two friends that I have, and he's a Braves fan also. And whenever the signing came through and the contract details came out, and talked about the opt-out, and I was like, well, he's not going to opt out unless 20 million of that is being paid to him this year and 9 million of that is going to be paid to him after the opt-out, because again, it's just the way he's played offensively. He's really probably closer to a $9 or $10 million guy a year, AAV, but we've also seen that the market for shortstops, I mean, look at the contract for Dansby Swanson. He got one of the highest contracts in the league for at shortstop, and he's strictly a defense first guy, which he is better offensively. I would take Dansby Swanson offensively over Ha-Seong Kim, but Dansby is the top defensive shortstop in the league, and he got paid over $20 million a year with the Chicago Cubs. So
he got like $26 or $27 million. I mean, he got a lot of money.
Right. Yeah. And so it does seem that the teams are starting to value defense at shortstop pretty highly, and the contracts have shown that so far, except for Trey Turner's, by the way.
Xander Bogaerts got a lot of money and had to move almost immediately to second base. So that was awesome. Right. That was what an unforced error there by the Padres. Okay. So kind of moving on from there a little bit, we have a trade by the Reds. We have a signing by the Royals. I know you have strong feelings about Carlos Estevez. So let's go to the Royal side of this first. They signed Carlos Estevez. I believe it's a 2-year deal, $22 million guarantee. It's a $13 million club option for 2027 with a $2 million buyout. So if they exercise the option, it's 3 years, $33 million. I don't think he's the closer. Like, Lucas Ursegg feels like the guy I would want closing, but this is closer money. Only one non-closing reliever that I can think of this cycle got over double-digit millions, and that's AJ Minter. So is Estevez the closer, or is Lucas Ursegg the closer in Kansas City?
So while you were saying that, I did go to FanGraphs to look at their roster resource, and they do have him listed above Lucas Ursegg, but they have both listed co-closers. As closer. So, teams have overvalued Carlos Estevez throughout the last couple of years.
Have I been saying this wrong? It's not Estevez. I did a whole Braves show and talked about him like a whole segment. Did I get this wrong the whole time?
You listen to my accent. Don't take my word on how to pronounce anybody's name.
I can get it right if it's Bubba. Okay.
I got Bubba. He's one of my two friends, but, Carlos Estevez, whoever he is, Carlos over there in Kansas City, he highly overperformed in the first half of his contract year, only in the first half. In the second half, he regressed tremendously. And he's going to regress even more because what he did in the first half of 2024 with the Los Angeles Angels is nowhere close to the pitcher that he is. And if the Royals are smart, they'll see that and not use him as a closer, but that remains to be seen. They are pretty good with their pitching, so I'm assuming that they'll stick with Lucas Ursegg as the main closer. But, I mean, if you look at Estevez's stats, his whip throughout his career up until the first half of 2024 was generally 1.2 or higher. And then even in the second half of 2024, in the first half with the Angels, it was down at 0.735. And in the second half, it was back up to 1.19 in his time with the Phillies. And he gives up way too many base runners to be a closer. He was a good closer on a team that was a bottom dweller in the major leagues with the Los Angeles Angels. And he's not fit for a closer role on a team that's contending for the playoffs. And I think that the Kansas City Royals did highly overpay him, and that's a lot of the recency bias that we've seen throughout the years. But hopefully, if they're smart, they won't use him as a closer.
I did take a caveat on the whip thing. Is he was in Colorado for a while early in his career, but to your point, his strikeout rate last year with the Angels, it was like 26%. With the Phillies, it was like under 21%. He did get more ground balls. He upped his ground ball rate to like 43% or something. Whereas with the Angels, he was almost exclusively a fly ball pitcher, one of the worst ground ball rates in the league. And I'm starting to kind of wonder if like Philly's defense not being great, if that was part of the reason why his whip and stuff ticked up, is he was getting more ground ball contact. But Trey Turner's not a good defender at short. You know, you have defensive questions all around the infield, really. And, you know, and in the outfield, too. Like, DeCastellanos is not a great defender either. And so even if they're getting balls in play, guys aren't making the plays. Maybe that's probably the reason it ticked up. I do think it's a little bit of an overpay, but at this point in the offseason, there's not a lot of other options. And having both Lucas Erceg and Carlos Estevez available, I do think Erceg's the better closer of the two, but Carlos has more experience. And I think that's something that they need on this team, because the pen really doesn't have a ton of guys with a ton of back-end experience. Like last year, Hunter Harvey, they got him from Washington in July, and that was a disaster. He barely pitched for them because of injury. You know, they got John Schreiber in spring training last year. I think he had two saves and an ERA of over 3.5 for them last year. So they needed some better guys here, more options. I still think that this lineup, even after going out and getting Jonathan India, I still think this team is kind of missing an outfielder. Like, they needed to go get a better corner outfielder. Your options here, they've got Hunter Renfroe and MJ Melendez in the corners, and they combined last year for negative 0.4 war and an OPS of like 680 with a strikeout rate of like 20-something%. And it just feels like they need to figure out their outfield. Kyle Isbell in center is fine. He's a good enough defender. Whatever. It's not a big deal. Who cares? But in your corner outfield spots, you got to do better than Hunter Renfroe and MJ Melendez if they want to not waste the talents of a Bobby Witt Jr., of a Vinny Pascantino, the back end of Salvador Perez's resurgent career, right? You just got Jonathan India. Your pitching staff was really good last year with Reagans and Lugo and Waka. And then when they acquired Michael Lorenzen, I love Michael Lorenzen. I think he's been way underrated.
Also,
yeah, but I just feel like they have to, like, this, you needed a back end reliever. Yes. That was too much money when you still have significant corner outfield questions. And there's no slam dunk improvements coming out of your farm system. Tyron Blanco, Nelson Velasquez, they're not better than Melendez and Renfroe. You do have outfielders, right? You've got Drew Waters, Joey Weimer, you acquired via trade in the India deal. Gavin Cross was your first rounder in 22. He's an NRI to spring training. I still don't necessarily know if he's ready for the majors. I think he was in double A. He finished the year double A last year. Like, yes, it was great to get a back end reliever. Did you have to give him this much? Could you have given somebody else less than this and gotten a corner outfielder? Probably would have been a better move. And so, yes, this helps your team, but it's not a great use of money, of what feels like limited amounts of money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they 100% need to get another outfielder. And I do want to also point out real quick, Estevez's yes. walk rate. His walk rate with Los Angeles in the first half of 2024 was 4%, which is elite.
Wow. Yeah.
And then in the second half with Philly, it was 8%.
Okay. Which so is, kind which of is, doubled.
Yeah. And yeah. So he doesn't have good control either. While he does give up a lot of hits, and that could have been on the Phillies offense, or I mean, I'm sorry, Phillies defense, he walks a lot of guys. He has a 3.5 walk per nine across his career. So okay. he does not
for
have
relieving good control. Right. I think it's anything awful there, right? Okay, another team that I think still needs to do more work in their outfield as well, the Cincinnati Reds. They acquired lefty Taylor Rogers from the Giants, which kind of wild because Taylor Rogers and his brother were finally reunited on the Giants roster, and so they go ahead and the Giants trade one of these guys away. he's got, I think, a $12 million salary owed for 2025. I think it's the final year of the deal, I believe. Cincinnati's getting $6 million to cover half of that. They gave up a minor league righty in return. As a setup guy here, right? Like, Taylor Rogers has been a setup guy. He's going to be the primary setup guy behind Alexis Diaz. Is this another scenario of, like, yes, it's only $6 million, and thankfully, but you still need to address your outfield? Or are there enough options here and you just need somebody, like, between signing Austin Hayes, to come in for left field. They have TJ Friedl. They have Jake Fraley. You've got guys who can fill in the outfield like Spencer Steer. Is this, do they have enough in their outfield where they can afford to focus on other things like a setup man? Or are they kind of pulling a Royals and ignoring the biggest need to fit to handle a small, are they not putting out the fire to handle a small, you know, a small broken shingle on the other side of the house?
Yeah, no. I think they're right there with the Royals as far as they needed to do more with their outfield. They should have been a team that, like we talked about at the, in the beginning of the offseason, they should have been a team that went after a guy like Anthony Santander real hard, or a guy like Teoscar Hernandez.
He would hit so many home runs in that ballpark.
Oh, my God, I know. Oh, and it's crazy. And instead, they sat on their hands until we're 11 days from pitchers and catchers reporting. And they sat on their hands and then signed Austin Hayes, who is best suited as a weak side platoon guy. Like, his OPS drops 81 points versus right-handed pitchers versus left-handed pitchers. And so it's and he's awful defensively. So
yeah,
there's no defense to speak of. And while Taylor Rogers is a good ad and I like the addition for the Reds, it's like you said, they're worried about a single broken shingle instead of putting out the fire in the kitchen.
I do want to kind of, I do think the difference here in the Royals is they do have some promising young outfielders in the farm system, like Rhys Hines and Blake Dunn. Season before last, I called a week of games for AA Montgomery, and they played Chattanooga, who is the AA affiliate for Cincinnati. And I got a chance to talk to and watch both Blake Dunn and Rhys Hines play. These dudes are insane. Like, Blake Dunn has surprising speed. Rhys Hines has one of the best outfield arms I think I've ever seen in person. Massive power from Hines. Like, these dudes can be impact makers. They just need more time to acclimate to the majors. And so I do think that's maybe the difference here, is you can see two impactful corner outfielders. I do think Dunn can play some center. He's probably not better than TJ Friedl, but I do think he can play some center field as well. So you do have some help coming, and it's just they're not ready. That's why you bring on a guy like an Austin Hayes. Jake Fraley's not bad. He's not good, but he's not bad. I mean, I want to say his OPS plus last, or his WRC plus was like 95 or so. Like, he's not awful, but he's not great. And the bigger question here is going to be how you configure the infield. And if you have a spot, maybe you can put Spencer Steer, you know, in an outfield spot in place of, in place of a Fraley or a Hayes or something, if you need to. But I do think the difference here is they do have some guys coming, and it's probably worth giving them a little bit of props for just having something. Whereas there's really nothing on the way for Kansas City either.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Reds could also go the route of the San Diego Padres or the Pittsburgh Pirates and move Ellie De La Cruz to the outfield. If all things considered, he hasn't been great defensively at shortstop. And so I think that if they have somebody else in mind at shortstop that could be better, I mean, you have to have Ellie in your lineup regardless of where he plays. And if they have somebody at shortstop that can be better defensively, then move him to the outfield.
I do think Ellie he kind of has a bad reputation from 23. I do think he was much better last year. I think StatCast has him as a well above average defender. If I remember right, I was digging in some fielding statistics the other day because I was trying to figure out why Jared Kelnick rated negatively. And Kelnick's answer was like, he screwed up some one-star catches, which are 95% catch probability. I think Ellie's had some notable misses on easy plays, but I think overall he does rate out as like one of the better defenders at short. At least he did last year from a StatCast perspective. I honestly think Matt McClain's probably the one you should move, because second base is easier to fill. And he did play center field at UCLA. It's not like it's completely new for him, like it would be for Ellie De La Cruz. He's played center field before. He did it in college. He did it some in the minors as well. It's not like it's just adjustment he has to make for the first time, like it is with O'Neill Cruz, where he was learning on the fly. I do think Ellie, leave him at short. You could also put him at third. I do think his arm is such an asset. You could put him at third, but Matt McClain's the one to me that I would move. Just kind of interesting how that works out. A team that kind of also followed some of these things, but they reinforce a strength versus addressing a need. The Detroit Tigers, they signed Tommy Canley to a one-year $7.75 million. When he's been healthy, he's been a really good setup man. He just has like 97 innings in like the last 5 years. Now, 80-something of those are in the last 2 years, but I think he only has like two blown saves in his last like 38 save or hold situations, which is nice. Is this something, since Detroit didn't really address their outfield other than Alex, I'm sorry, their pitching staff, the rotation, other than Alex Cobb, do you think adding Tommy Canley into that bullpen is just a way to maybe affordably mitigate the existing weakness of their rotation? Or is this something where it doesn't matter if they can't, if they don't sign Alex Bregman to get the veteran leadership and the experience in the infield?
I think they still definitely need to sign Alex Bregman if they want to have any shot at repeating 2024 and making the playoffs in 2025. But as far as the pitching goes, I think they've kind of followed in the footsteps of the Los Angeles Dodgers and the New York Mets, where they know that their pitching is not really in a different way than the Dodgers, for sure. Their pitching is not as good in the starting rotation, so they're loading up on relievers to kind of even out that balance, because in the Dodgers situation, their starting rotation, most of it's going to be on the injured list. In the Mets starting rotation, it's just not great. And so they loaded up on bullpen, and the Dodgers loaded up on the bullpen to make up for the time that their starters are going to miss. And for the Tigers, their rotation is Tariq Skubal and the boys. And so it's they're loading up on the bullpen to kind of fill in the gaps there where the rest of the rotation after Tariq Skubal is going to be dropping the ball, literally and figuratively.
I do think there is a path to just improvement from getting full seasons from a lot of this infield, like, or this roster in general. Like Parker Meadows, 2.1 WAR in half a year. You're going to get a full season of him barring injury. Gleyber Torres should outproduce Colt Keith at second base. I could see a full additional WAR over what Colt Keith produced. Colt Keith should easily outproduce Spencer Torkelson at first. Jace Young and whoever else is in that third base platoon should outproduce Gio Urshela, who was so awesome for them last year. They DFA'd him like halfway through the year. Anybody at shortstop, Trey Sweeney, whoever it is better than Javi Baez. Like, I can see some natural improvement here at a lot of positions already. And so I do think the addition of Bregman would be big from an experience standpoint and a veteran leadership standpoint. I do think that you can expect a lot of these positions to just naturally upgrade already based on different personnel and rotations and full seasons for some of these hurt guys. So I do think that helps a little bit. You know, like Matt Vierling needs to just do what he did again for a full season. Riley Green put up 4 WAR in left field. He needs to do that again for a full season. But outside of that, just about every other position is one where you can see them getting better just from getting full seasons of their better options than what they had the year before. And then, like you said, the rotation is still a question mark, right? You know it's not good enough, so you beef up their bullpen because you know you can make the bullpen work, right? You did this last year. You know this will work. So I think it's a decent move. Before I forget, the Discord asked us to do this a week ago, and I forgot, but there's been some rule changes recently and some new things going on that I want to kind of make sure that we cover. And my apologies to you guys in the Discord for missing this a week ago and forgetting to do this. One, you're going to see the challenge system, the automated balls and strikes challenge system, be tested with major leaguers in spring training. Not every game, not every ballpark set up for StatCast, but the ones that are, there will be the ability. I think it's 2 challenges per team per game. They moved it down from 3 to 2. Reminder how this works. It has to be the pitcher, the catcher, or the hitter, or the batter has to call for the challenge. It has to be within like a second or two. You can't check with the dugout and do all of that. You have to decide almost right away. They put it up on the board. If you've watched a AAA game that does this, it adds maybe 20 seconds to the game. But it feels like almost every single time that we watch and we get a challenge, it was the umpire being wrong and the challenger being right. So I do think that this is going to be, I think once they do this trial, it's going to be, people don't like the idea right now, just from what I've seen on the internet. But I think once you do it, it's going to be incredibly popular because you're going to see like mistakes corrected from the umpire, like by like umpire mistakes corrected, and the hitter who, you know, who probably knows better than the umpire what's a ball and a strike, getting it right, or the pitcher getting the call that he should have gotten originally with minimal interruption. Are you hyped for this preview of the challenge system in the major leagues in spring training?
Oh, God, yeah. I am so excited for this. This is going to be awesome, especially once it gets fully implemented in the Major League Baseballs. I mean, how many lawsuits is Angel Hernandez going to file against the Major League Baseball once it is implemented? That's insane.
This computer is biased against me.
Right. But on the other hand, I will say that with this system in place, we will not get as many explosions from batters, like the Kyle Schwarber explosion on Sunday Night Baseball.
That was so good.
Angel Hernandez was the umpire. Yeah. And then guys like, but it will keep guys like Kyle Schwarber in the game longer, and Bryce Harper, who gets thrown out 5 or 6 times a year because of balls and strikes. So
nice.
There's good and there's bad to it. But no, I'm very excited for it.
Nice. Okay. The other two actual rule changes, the first one, minor, it involves the shift. Previously, if you violated the shift ban, right, if you crossed over second base before the play or whatever the infielder did, the team that was hitting had their choice of the result of the play. Like if the guy was safe, he could just stay on base, or an automatic ball. Now it would be the result of the play or a free base. So if you ground into an out, but they violated the shift ban, instead of just getting an automatic ball and going back to the plate to keep the at-bat going, you just get first base. And if there's runners on, they all move up a base. The hitter's not credited with an at-bat. The fielder is charged with an error. So I think that's an interesting change there. The bigger one is on base running. And this is the one that's a little bit confusing to people. So there was this thing, the Cardinals started this, where let's say there's a runner on first and a runner on third, okay? And a ground ball in the infield. And there's two outs already, okay? What the Cardinals started doing is, rather than sliding into second base and hoping that you beat the play, they would just run through the bag. Because the idea is you're not having to slow down to stop at the bag. They would run through the bag, and if you beat the ball to the bag and you ran through, the play is still alive, and the guy running home from third would have time to score before you were tagged out, because they have to tag you out now. What they're doing, the rule change now, is rather than having to wait for the umpire to call the runner out for abandonment, where they're just not trying to advance bases, they ran into the outfield or whatever, now the replay official can look and see the at the moment where the second foot touches the clay past the bag, they can rule the play over out at that moment and can review to see if the runner scored before the second foot comes down. So MLB's trying to get rid of that strategy where you could just run through the bag and make them tag you, but the play's alive long enough for the guy to score. Because now the second, like the moment you're the second foot comes down past the bag, they can call you out on replay. And if the runner hasn't scored by that point, the run doesn't count. This happens so rarely. I honestly don't mind. It's weird to watch, mind you. And a lot of guys have gotten better. And I think the only real change that'll happen now is instead of guys just sprinting straight to the outfield, they'll just turn and keep going. Like they'll just turn and keep going to third and make you tag them. But either way, it's an interesting little the chess game of teams trying to find every possible edge that they can to find ways to manufacture offense in an era that feels like it's increasingly dominated by pitching.
Yeah, no, I agree. And your explanation of that was a lot better than the one in the article that I read. So now I understand how that rule works. But no, yeah, it's teams. It's again, just teams trying to find any loophole they can in the rules to get any advantage that they can necessary, whether it be on the field or off the field. And rules are in place for a reason. I mean, you can't stretch the rules all the time, and it's Major League Baseball trying to say, hey, we see the loophole y'all are finding and we're going to close it.
Exactly. This has been First Pitch for Thursday, January 30th. We may or may not be back tomorrow. Let's see if some stuff happens. We're going to start previewing different divisions, different teams, contenders probably starting next week. So there'll be probably more shows from here on out simply because pitchers and catchers report soon and we'll have previews to do. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, listening on audio, do us a favor, leave us a 5-star review. If you're on YouTube, subscribe to the channel, hit the notification bell, send your friends firstpitchpodcast.com to go watch it themselves. Until next time, this has been First Pitch.